Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Charlotte Dennett. She is a journalist, an attorney, and author, and her latest book is The People Versus Bush, One Lawyer's Campaign to Bring the President to Justice and the National Grassroots Movement She Encounters Along the Way. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Pleasure to be on.
So you had an encounter which was the kind of archetypal I read a book that changed my life encounter with Vincent Bugliosi, whose book is called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Tell us about that book and what followed, the chain of events that followed from it.
Well, a friend had told me about the book during the late summer of 2008. She knew that I had tentatively decided to run for attorney general in Vermont. Being a lawyer, I'm a member of the Progressive Party. There's three parties in Vermont, and they needed someone to run for that position. So I tentatively accepted. And she put the book in my hands, knowing that I was also a journalist, that I'd had some experience in the Middle East. And she said she thought I'd be very interested in his book. And then she said, rather cryptically, I think there's something in there that we in our different separate states can do about the problem of Bush sending our troops to war on false pretenses. And she left it at that. So about a week later, I had the opportunity to start skimming through the book. And what I found was that it was very interestingly laid out. The first part established the evidence for him to actually make a case that is not an easy case to make in front of a skeptical public who doesn't really think of the fact that their former head of state could actually be liable for crimes and actually be prosecuted once he's out of office. So Bugliosi made that case first. And then, and it does really boil down to sending our troops to war on a lie, and he goes into why Bush really knew that it was a lie. He claimed that we were going to war because Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat to our nation, when Bush had actually been advised by his own intelligence agencies immediately before going on the television that did not come to such a dire conclusion. So he took the worst reading and said the man was a threat when in fact he was not. That is the easiest way I can explain the basis for his charge. I can go into it more if you want. But then, in the second half of the book, he does in fact lay out all the legal framework for doing this. And the part that really struck me is when he said that any attorney general or any district attorney could actually do this using state criminal statutes. And that gave me pause because I wasn't an attorney general, but I was running for attorney general. And it just got me thinking that, first of all, probably there weren't going to be a whole lot of attorney generals that were going to risk their position to raise an issue like this. And secondly, I began to think about the state of Vermont, and its animus against Bush was very well known to all of us. The polls had been done. 60% of the people in Vermont were very much opposed to his war in Iraq, and there'd been 37 towns that had voted to impeach him in town meetings.
I mean, that's huge. 37 towns in Vermont had voted to impeach the President of the United States.
Yes, that's right. And they had done so because there were some activists that got together. They brought Cindy Sheehan, the peace mom, to Vermont to talk about how she'd been affected by the war. And there were also a couple of Iraq war veterans. And they actually toured all these towns in Vermont. They got into a bus and did the tour and gave their testimony. And based on that, the Vermont people responded and sent that message. And then there was one other thing that was rather charming, I guess you could use that word, is that the town of Brattleboro actually got a resolution passed that stated that that authorized their sheriff to arrest Bush if he ever stepped foot in Vermont. And that was sort of a symbolic message, but it was like a shot that was heard around the country. And so that suggested to me that I would have a lot of support in my state if I actually decided to take up the prosecution of Bush as one of my issues as Attorney General. And the final thought was that we have the highest percentage of deaths per capita of soldiers in the war. Even though we're a small state, we bear the cost disproportionately. So for all those reasons, I began to give it serious thought. That's a long answer to your question.
Yeah, well, I mean, so you decided to run for Attorney General in as a part of the member of the Progressive Party against a strong incumbent who is a Democrat. And so you mounted this campaign. Did you run on basically I want to prosecute George Bush platform?
Well, it was one of a number of issues. Obviously, if I just made that my single issue, I would have had very little credibility. And I actually did a lot of research about what the Attorney General does. It's a very powerful position. And I hadn't realized quite how many responsibilities the Attorney General has when I first started to consider this. But I did a lot of research. And I mean, the Attorney General is responsible in Vermont not only with conducting criminal prosecutions, but also doing civil litigation against, for instance, out-of-state polluters. And one of the issues that, or in-state polluters, or people involved in fraud. And, of course, we were dealing with gas guzzling and predatory banking. These are all issues that I dealt with. Another one was the need to close down Vermont Yankee, an aging nuclear power plant in our state, which is a very big issue. So I took on all of those issues. But, of course, you can well imagine that the idea of prosecuting Bush for murder is the issue that really attracted all the media attention, along with the fact that I was able to contact Vincent Bugliosi. I asked him if he had found anyone yet who had stepped forward to do this prosecution, and he said he'd come close but not yet. And so, to make a long story short, I met him in about a week after I called him. He happened to be flying east to attend a conference in Andover, Mass. On planning for the prosecution of high government officials for war crimes. This was held on behalf of the dean of the Massachusetts School of Law. So there were attorneys that came from all over the country meeting at this place in Andover, Mass. I had the chance to go down there to meet them, talk with Bugliosi, check out other theories, check out what they thought of Bugliosi, and I was sufficiently convinced that there really was a legal mechanism to do this that I had Bugliosi come up and join me in my press conference in Burlington, Vermont. And so there we were together, and we got a lot of press. And from then on, there was just huge interest in this aspect of my campaign.
It's interesting to me that our Constitution and founding documents do allow for attorneys general to prosecute on a federal level. Obviously, it's preferable if a prosecution of a president is done on the federal level, but it can be done by an attorney general from any one of the states.
Yes, and I think that the person who really cut the new ground on that was Vincent Bugliosi. He's very famous. He's very well respected among the attorney community, if you want to call it that, in the United States, particularly as a prosecutor, because he had successfully prosecuted the Manson family and wrote a book about it called Helter Skelter, which I'm amazed at the number of people that know that book. But he also had this reputation for winning his cases. I think it's like 103 out of 4 felony cases he successfully prosecuted, and all of his murder cases he had prosecuted successfully. So that was a person that I felt very comfortable with in relying on his expertise. And he spent months in law libraries putting together his case. I think probably one of the most interesting aspects of the case that he helped to develop is the idea that the perpetrator of the crime does not have to be in the state to commit the crime. And he would know this very well, because my understanding is that when he prosecuted Charles Manson for the murders of Sharon Tate and others, he was not at the scene. But you don't have to be at the scene. And I'll just give you a couple of examples so that people understand that this is not as far out as it might seem at first glance. One way is simply you bring a conspiracy charge. And if you are engaged in a conspiracy, you don't necessarily have to be there. All that you have to show is that you entered into an agreement with two or more other people, and then you set about an overt act that takes place in the state where you want jurisdiction to prosecute. And so the argument that Bugliosi made was the overt act that Bush, Cheney, and others had was Bush going on television in October and convincing the and people from all over the country that Saddam Hussein was a threat to our nation when in fact he was not. And as you may recall, I mean, it wasn't just the weapons of mass destruction. It was that he was a threat, that he was tied to 9/11, and it was on the basis of this that on these lies that young soldiers signed up, went to war, and some of them died. So that's how you can establish jurisdiction. Then there's another argument that I'll bring up, which is called the doctrine of innocent agent. And of all the people that really understood this was Cindy Sheehan, who had lost her son in Iraq. And she once told Bugliosi, he recounted this story to me when he was up visiting, that she said, you know, it wasn't the Iraqis that killed my son. It was Bush. And he said, well, you're absolutely right, and there's a legal doctrine that backs up that concept. And that is that, again, the perpetrators caused something to happen. In this case, it was sending troops to war, and it was an illegal sending them to war, and because there was no basis for it, and it wasn't approved. I mean, we can get into Congress giving not declaring war, but giving approval, but based on a lie, and fraud vitiates consent. So congressional approval doesn't really count. But the point is, he sent the troops on this invasion, and the Iraqi troops had a right to respond, and because their land was being invaded, and so they killed soldiers, but they were actually the innocent agents. The actual perpetrator was the person who caused the invasion.
We're talking to journalist and attorney Charlotte Dennett. One of the things that you bring up, which is, I think, close to your heart, partly because you yourself worked as a journalist in Iraq, but that all of us who were witnessing this whole period from 9/11 to throughout the Bush administration that we witnessed was the cavalier attitude that George Bush had, particularly Bush, within all of his administration about war. He seemed to have planned it. Doesn't seem to. He clearly, there are facts that demonstrate that he did plan it before 9/11, and that he enjoyed every moment of it and had absolutely no sense of the massive death and destruction both to us and to Iraqi people that he was causing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And when I'm sure there are a number of your listeners who believe that this is not the first time that the United States government has committed our troops to war on false pretenses. It's happened before in the past, but the point is this: I don't think ever before has it been so well documented that the president not only plotted to get us into war long before he even became president, but that it didn't bother him. And this is what's so exceptional about this case. It really didn't seem to bother him. One of the things that I think really illustrates this is an ad that we devised in my campaign, and I think that people can still see it on YouTube. If you just Google Charlotte Dennett for Attorney General and you look for YouTube, you're going to see a three-minute ad there that I think really, really sort of covers it. And you see Bush there joking at a, I think it's a correspondence dinner about weapons of mass destruction, where he says, oops, can't find them here, and then the audience laughs. And, oh, look over there, can't seem to find them over there. Everybody laughs, you know, look under the table, there's no weapons of mass destruction. And then you see juxtaposed a picture of families who are grieving for their loved ones who got killed in this war. And that, to me, said it all, is this incredible callousness on his part. Now, one of the things that my book does is that I think other books that deal with the Bush administration and the war don't go into at the same depth, is that his goal was Iraq's oil, and that his decision to go in again happened even before he got into power, but that the first item on the agenda once his national security team met in 2000, this is before 2001, was how are they going to get into Iraq? And now the evidence has eventually dribbled out one way or the other from people within his administration that it was Iraq oil that they wanted. And then I elaborate in my book about the great game for oil and how this was one of the overwhelming issues that propelled the Bush administration into Iraq.
And funny enough, the one person in the Bush administration who was absolutely straightforward about it was Alan Greenspan.
Yes, yes, that's true. And if people remember when his book came out, that was the quotable quote when he said, let's face it, it's about oil. So he was one of several that talked about it. Wolfowitz was another one who was part of Bush's inside team in the Pentagon. And I quote him in the book as saying, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was that the hope was that there would be oil flowing to Haifa, Palestine, now Israel, shortly after the war commenced. And this is something that is often overlooked as well, is that the plan was to get rid of Saddam Hussein, who was resistant to a pipeline being reopened connecting the oil of Iraq with the port of Haifa. It had been built in the 30s and had been very useful during the war effort in World War II because there's a huge refinery in Haifa. And so the plan was that Saddam Hussein, who has never been a friend of Israel, was not going to ship Iraqi oil to Israel. And so the plan was regime change, get rid of him and put Ahmed Chalabi, who was living in exile at the time, in the position of the prime minister's office. Or in fact, and to this extent, it did actually play out that he became oil minister once Saddam was overthrown. But that was the idea, was to open the pipeline. And they all knew about it, that Wolfowitz and his fellow conservatives, and I do describe this in the book, they all knew that once you seize the oil, that's only half the problem. The other thing is you gotta find a route to ship it. And to them, the most logical route was from Iraq to Haifa. And then my book quotes Asia Times, saying, and this is just weeks after the invasion, that, quote, Iraqi consent, and that is to build the pipeline, will be out of the question as long as the current nationalist Saddam Hussein is in power, as acknowledged by the Israeli minister, his name is Peretzky. A prerequisite for that was a new regime in Baghdad with friendly ties with Israel. And as people may recall, Ahmed Chalabi was the source for the series of New York Times articles by Judith Miller claiming that there were weapons of mass destruction. And then we found out that that was false, which brought great discredit upon Chalabi, upon Judith Miller, and the New York Times. But that was the thinking in those days. They were going to resurrect the pipeline. It had fallen into disuse. It had not. It had been closed after the war for independence in 1948, and so the whole plan was to reopen the pipeline. And I think that they're still hoping that they can do that.
We're talking to Charlotte Dennett. She's author of the book, The People Versus Bush, One Lawyer's Campaign to Bring the President to Justice and the National Grassroots Movement She Encounters Along the Way.
So when you talk about this, it becomes clear, as it already is to probably many of our listeners, is that it has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein's actions, except in the sense that they stand in the way of the U.S. government, and it had nothing to do with 9/11. It was just purely strategic and essentially motives of empire that were the cause of this.
Yes, how tragic it is. And some people may say, well, you know, you need the oil. And the fact of the matter is, what I call the great game for oil is a very vicious game. It's not a game. It's ruthless. It's a very subterranean game, so that there's often not a lot written about it in the newspapers. But it's happening nonetheless. And because there's the concern that there are now finite sources of oil, it's going to get even more vicious, and there are going to be more and more wars. And that's what the war on terror is all about. The war on terror is really how to send troops to protect oil resources and their pipeline routes. And I'm not the first to say it. One of the first people who said this was Ted Koppel. He did a series of amazing documentaries, which I will never forget. He did them, I don't know, it must have been about 10 years ago. He was on to it. That sending off troops was, quote-unquote, to protect oil installations was, quote-unquote, all in the name of the war on terror. And, of course, we're going to follow the war on terror in Africa. We're going to follow the war on terror in Colombia. So what I'm saying to folks is just follow the pipelines, and you're going to understand it a lot better.
So follow the pipelines is a subset of follow the money.
Yeah.
Now, You did not win in your bid for Attorney General of the state of Vermont, but you kept going and basically got involved with what is called the accountability movement.
Yes. The people that came to my immediate assistance once they heard about my race, which was widely publicized, AP did a big story, so you got out to a lot of newspapers. And it was all over the internet. I mean, I was actually amazed at the response that I got. And a lot of the people that wanted to help were disaffected impeachment activists. They had become so disgusted at what they saw as a lack of resolve and weak-kneed behaviors on the part of the leadership of the Democratic Party that they began to consider prosecution as being another way to go. And so I met some of them at this conference that was held at the Massachusetts School of Law on prosecuting high-level government officials for war crimes. And they were, it wasn't just impeachment activists, there were attorneys. They wanted this conference to happen because they were very upset that the press was not adequately covering the whole question of torture. I mean, we saw it when Abu Ghraib came out, but then it began to, and that was back in 2004, but now I'm talking 2008, and there'd been some torture memos that had been leaked to the New York Times, and the ACLU had been able to declassify some documents and get them released through FOIA, but nonetheless, they felt that there just wasn't adequate concern about what do we do about it. And by the way, I should say Bugliosi was also one of the people who said that the press had reported the war and how the weapons of mass destruction was basically a fraud. But so what do we do about it? And that was one of the motivating things for me, that I was not only a journalist, but I was an attorney, and there was something that I could do about it that he pointed out. So I think that resonated with a lot of people. I got emails and calls from all over the country. And when I lost the campaign, I had to think about what am I going to do now, because I need to do something about this. And that's when it occurred to me that I could do two things. Number one would be to write a book about these wonderful people that I met. And I describe who they are, many of them are just, they're average Americans who never got involved in politics before. I know that two of the people that worked on my campaign both had fathers who were Air Force pilots during World War II. Another person who worked in my campaign, her father was a military attaché and with the State Department. In fact, she and I both discovered that we'd both been conceived in Jordan. My father was OSS, and he was a major, actually he was a major intelligence operative in counterintelligence, but he was also a diplomat. He was a cultural attaché and, in fact, had died under sort of mysterious circumstances when I was just an infant. But at any rate, so this was the core of our campaign, and then we just kept reaching out and reaching out to average Americans who really cared that their democracy seemed to be slipping through their fingers. They were absolutely appalled by our diminished reputation in the world, that we were now being viewed as torturers and murderers. And then what I did, once I decided to write the book, I began to find that after Obama took office, two really significant things happened. At the outset, he had a website which indicated that the number one wish on that website from his supporters was to do a thorough investigation of the Bush administration. And that was in like November, December. And then by February 2009, polls had been done, Gallup polls, USA Today polls, and they found that the majority of Americans wanted a criminal investigation of the Bush administration. So people were really feeling this very deeply. And as you remember, Obama put out his famous message that he preferred to go forward and not look backward. And what that did is it did tamp down some of the movement, which decided that, well, maybe we should give Obama the benefit of the doubt and see how he does. And as you recall, he did do some things. He said, we will not torture anymore. He did an executive order on that. And he pledged to close down Guantanamo. But as time wore on, people who were in human rights work in particular began to see that he was carrying on some of the same positions and actions as the Bush administration, and this alarmed them. And this is the core of the accountability movement. It's people who, they're activists, of course, people who are involved in the anti-war movement, and lawyers, and people in human rights. That's the core of it that I started to work with. And I found out that there were wonderful, brave people who would put on those orange jumpsuits and demonstrate outside the Department of Justice, outside Congress and the White House, hardly ever got covered by the national press, which is why I wanted to honor them on the cover of the book. And you'll see a person, a protester in an orange jumpsuit. I have shown that picture to so many people, and they had no idea these demonstrations were going on. So you have the diehards, so to speak, during the early months of the Obama administration. But what's happening now is that more and more people are beginning to realize that Obama seems to be restrained. He can't seem to be his own person on everything concerning foreign policy and national security, and that we have to keep the pressure up. And so they're beginning to come out of their suspended animation, if you want to call it. And I'm meeting with some people out on the West Coast in a week, where we're going to put our heads together to see how we can grow the accountability movement, because it's not just legal accountability. It's not just with regard to the war, of course. Ideally, it's going to expand to deal with issues of, for instance, financial accountability, which is a huge issue right there.
We're talking to attorney, journalist, and author Charlotte Dennett. Her book is called The People vs. Bush, One Lawyer's Campaign to Bring the President to Justice and the National Grassroots Movement She Encounters Along the Way. I think when you quote that famous Obama quote of, it's time to look forward and not back, that points to a double standard. So, for example, if in Santa Fe, New Mexico, somebody murders somebody, you don't say, well, let's look forward and not back. You put them on trial for murder and send them to jail. But when we're talking about our leaders, and especially the people at the highest level, that kind of thing happens because there's a kind of perceived and sometimes real or partially real immunity to justice. And that's part of what you talk about in your book, is that immunity.
Yes. In fact, I give it a name. I call it sovereign impunity.
Right.
And it's something that I did discover as I researched this book. Not only I had to really understand how power operates in our country and at the highest level. And that's when I realized that there's this incredible double standard that exists. And actually, it probably doesn't come as a great surprise to people, but you really have to take on the very powerful to understand that they think that they are above the law. And they shouldn't be above the law. The law is supposed to apply to everybody. And one of my favorite images of that is Lady Justice, the statue of the woman who is cloaked in robes holding the scales of justice, and they're equal. And in many cases, I actually describe this in the book, in many cases, Lady Justice, who goes back to Roman times, by the way, is pictured with a blindfold, which is supposed to mean that justice is impartial, that it doesn't matter what station you're from, that you should have equal treatment. And we know that in the real world this doesn't happen, and that the rich get off, the very rich and the very powerful. And then I found out that even the laws are constructed in a way that makes it very difficult, particularly if you're going to engage in a civil lawsuit against a government official. Then what you're going to run up is this concept. It's called sovereign immunity. It's very hard to actually win in a civil lawsuit. Sovereign immunity means the king can do no wrong, and it actually has its origin in British law under the monarchy, and it's evolved in our country. And even, by the way, the position of attorney general. The attorney general was the attorney for the monarch. And so I have found in the course of my own legal practice, where I've tried to sue the government and found it very hard to win, and in Vermont, in a particular case I was involved in, I had to go up against the Attorney General's office, whose job it is to protect government officials if they've done wrong. And, boy, just getting around that is so difficult. Because they'll come up, there are all sorts of legal excuses for why government officials are sort of out of bounds. You have to show really, really egregious, almost criminally negligent behavior before you can succeed. And so civil lawsuits against, for instance, former high government officials, I can think of Henry Kissinger as an example, did not succeed when they were brought. But it's different with criminals. With criminal behavior, then there is no immunity. So that's why we've got to focus on that, number one. But number two, then you've got to get the will to do it. And the only way we're going to get the will to do it is, A, educate the public to know that we can do it, and then convince our elected officials that it should be done, and convince the Attorney General on a federal level that it must be done. But I found out that after there was this incredible show of public sentiment right after Obama got elected, two things happened. Not only Obama saying, I want to look forward and not backward, although he did sort of leave this gray area for that if the Attorney General found real wrongdoing, maybe he should follow it. And he has, by the way. Holder has. People should not forget, Holder has appointed a special prosecutor to look into some particularly egregious acts of torture by the CIA. So that is happening. But meanwhile, on other issues, Obama has sort of followed his own dictum on this. And then Senator Patrick Leahy, my own senator from Vermont, who is the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he came out with this concept of a truth commission, which all told, and I analyze it in the whole chapter in the book, I think that it was a way to let people blow off steam and think that this might be a more plausible route to follow. And many of us did not agree because we thought, hey, you've got criminal law in the statutes. We've got all the evidence we need. We don't need any more truth commissions. We already know, it's so well documented, that crimes were committed at the highest level. And in the end, there was a group of us Vermonters that confronted Leahy. We sat down with him and we said, why are you doing this? And that's when he admitted to us that there was not going to be a truth commission, that he couldn't get one Republican to come behind the idea. But I had people in Washington tell me that he knew all along there wasn't going to be a truth commission, that the Republicans would never go along with it. So that was, in a way, I saw that as kind of a diversion. But in the process, I really did study it. I also studied and talked about Leahy's record in Congress, and he's certainly one of the better senators. He certainly tried to put Attorney General Ashcroft's feet to the fire, and then Gonzales, who succeeded him. And one of Leahy's aides told us in a moment of exasperation, he said, you know, it's really hard when you're a lone person out there trying to bring justice. And then he said, he's all you have. And that really caused us to ponder those words, us five Vermonters, after Senator Leahy had left the room with his aide. And all we could think of is, if Leahy is all we have, we are in big trouble.
One of the objections that you ran into was people saying, well, yeah, you know, bad things were done, but hey, it was time of war. And basically, the implication is that anything is legal in war. What is the actual law on that? It seems like there actually are both national and international laws regulating the conduct of what is legal and what is illegal within war. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. And the whole area of aggressive war, for instance, which was determined from the time of the Nuremberg trials as a war crime, nonetheless, has not been codified by the International Criminal Court as of yet, although there is a meeting that's going to happen this summer. And so that trying to go after Bush for conducting a war of aggression was deemed to be impossible at the time when I took this up, because there's still controversy as to what exactly is a war of aggression, so they've got to work it out in committees before that's going to be carried forth under the International Criminal Court of The Hague. Also, the United States is not a signatory to that, interestingly enough. And that's one thing that people should clamor Obama over, to get him to be a signatory to the ICC, so that we can pursue more of the war crimes charges. But the question of pursuing a former president on a murder charge, that is novel. And, you know, the law expands according to the times that we're in. And that's why I found Bugliosi's arguments to actually be very plausible. If many people say, well, Congress consented, and therefore it's okay, but Congress was lied to, you see. So, again, this whole idea of Congress giving consent to this war, it doesn't work. And when we get into the question of intent to kill, there are two ways that you can get around that. The most difficult charge to prove is that he absolutely that Bush absolutely knew that he was sending troops off to war that were going to die, and that he did it on false pretenses. And that's how it would be argued in the case against Bush if we were to conduct it in Vermont. But there's also second-degree murder, which is implied malice. It doesn't require an intent to kill. It simply requires a showing that Bush intended to do an inherently dangerous act with wanton and reckless disregard for the consequences and an indifference to human life. And I think that that state of mind can certainly be shown by Bush's actions and his behavior during all of this war.
We're talking to author, journalist, and attorney Charlotte Dennett. I think another point that becomes very evident in your book is the crucial importance of media and public opinion, just as much or more so in getting the accountability movement, getting prosecutions, getting truth, getting justice. They're as important or more important than the facts of the case and the law of the case.
Yeah, the media is so critical to this, and we all know that it took the media forever to catch up to what had happened in getting involved in this war. There's a very good book out there by the author Christina Borgerson. It's called Feet to the Fire, Media After 9/11, and she interviews all the really top media people and asks them, why didn't you understand anything about this war? Why did you just go along with what the Bush administration did? And they all give various reasons for why they dropped the ball, but the most astonishing reaction was that that she found after interviewing so many people was that no one could agree why we had even gone into the war. And I think that that requires a degree of knowledge of not only politics, but economics and history that journalists should have. They're lacking that, and I think that reflects on our journalism schools. But the other problem is that our media have become so incredibly corporate-controlled as well. And I remember seeing the observation that media is supposed to be the watchdog. Media is supposed to sound the alarm and be skeptical of what its government does, and now it's become part of the problem. The media, of course, certain networks being worse than others, in my humble opinion, that they just go along with what the government tells them and without question. This is very disturbing to me. I think it's going on with Afghanistan now. I don't think that the necessary probing is going on as to whether there are other reasons why we're in Afghanistan other than hunting down the Taliban, for instance. And that's why public radio is so critical and all forms of alternative media, because it's an informed public that's going to start putting pressure on their elected officials. As long as our people are not informed, then we're stuck with the status quo.
And Obama himself has said on more than one occasion that if I, as president, he says, I'm going to get anything done, I need a very strong popular movement backing me.
Yes, and that actually affected me when I wrote this book, People versus Bush, that I never forgot what he said, and I want to take him to task for that. And also to the people out there that are listening, is that he won't change course on some of these human rights issues, I think. For instance, the continuing of detention, the renditions are still going on, apparently. This is plucking up suspected terrorists and sending them off to black sites. And I've heard that the abuse in the prison is still going on, despite his executive order. And his Justice Department has sided with Bush administration positions on, for instance, the whole warrantless wiretapping issue that occurred where the Bush administration wanted to give immunity to the telecom companies, and the Obama administration Justice Department officials took the same stance. There's a lot of areas where these national security issues are preventing and arguments like protecting state secrets and national security, which the Obama Justice Department has used, that is very upsetting to human rights attorneys and anyone who cares about civil liberties. So you have to keep putting the pressure on. I think ACLU has done a fantastic job of alerting us to what we need to do. And in some cases, we've really had an impact. I think one of the biggest areas where the public had an impact was back in April 09 when Obama was trying to decide whether or not to release torture memos that had been ordered by a federal judge to be released to ACLU that would give us more understanding of how the Justice Department attorneys had come up with these incredibly bogus legal rationales for why it's okay to torture prisoners and detainees. And so he eventually did release those memos. And, boy, once the toothpaste was out of the tube, it's there. The evidence is there. I'm part of a group called the Justice Robert Jackson Steering Committee that takes its name from the chief prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials. And we are absolutely determined to pursue the war crimes issues because we know that two Justice Department officials under Bush, John Yoo and Jay Bybee, were really simply, to use the term, memoing up for their bosses. They knew that torture had been committed, and they knew that this was before there was any legal justification for it, and that the highest echelons of the Bush administration was nervous about that. So they concocted these phony reasons for why it was okay to torture. And a lot of that evidence has come out of the memos that Obama ordered to have released. And, the CIA came down on him very heavily for doing that. But I think it happened because of public pressure. And we're still doing FOIAs on those documents. I've been involved in that. And I think it's the result of our work that a lot of documents were released just recently in the past couple of months about an ethics probe, an internal ethics probe inside the Justice Department as to how these lawyers, which we call the torture lawyers, came to the conclusions that they did and tried to get away with covering up criminal behavior on the part of CIA, but also the higher-ups who had authorized the torture. And even though a top-level Justice Department overruled the ethics lawyers just 2 months ago, we're not giving up on this. We are pursuing it. We are appealing a FOIA case. And I just want to tell the viewers that we're going to continue in the spirit of Nuremberg. You know, the Chief Justice Jackson said that the principles of Nuremberg, which hold war criminals accountable for their acts, they apply to the victors and not just the vanquished. Now, of course, he said that right after World War II, and as a result of the Nuremberg trials, as we all know, the Nazi war criminals, some of them, even lawyers, were hung for what they did. But what he said is, if the poison chalice should pass to our lips or the lips of our leaders, we must hold them accountable. And so there's a group of us, and we're going to do it. And our movement is growing.
It's unfortunately time to go, but we've been talking with Charlotte Dennett. She is a journalist, attorney, and author, and her newest book is called The People Versus Bush, One Lawyer's Campaign to Bring the President to Justice and the National Grassroots Movement She Encounters Along the Way. If people want to get in touch with you or get involved in this kind of work, is there a website where they should start?
Yes, you can go to peoplevbush.com, and that will give all the links on how to reach me and to find out the latest. They can join the Accountability Now on Facebook, and you'll find other people. We're just starting to build that. And you can. It also links to my publisher. People can get the book through Amazon.com, of course. But in any way, this is how people can find out more about the book and the movement. It's all there.
Charlotte, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much. I so much enjoyed the interview.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.